Hey, Anna. Now, I know you always hear about space travel sending humans to Mars, but how come they never talk about going to Venus?
Is this a joke or like, are you asking
I'm
me?
I'm really asking you. Oh. What do you think? I mean, Venus.
Well, I don't know because I feel like, isn't Venus closer?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Venus can get to about, 26 million miles away from Earth. Yeah. Whereas Mars, the closest you can get is about 35 million miles. Why don't we go to Venus?
I don't know. And I bet it could be romantic because it's like Venus and like that could be like, it was like a couple's destination or something.
Yeah. So, well.
Are you about to answer your own question?
Yeah, there's a really real answer. And the real answer is Venus has a temperature 900 degrees Fahrenheit all the time.
So it's a little tropical.
It's a slight. A bit hot and humid in the fact that you would melt into a pile of goop. So
that's going to be a hard pass for me.
So, okay. So then you are all aboard with On to Mars.
Let's do this.
Awesome. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, this is Looking Up, and I'm Dean Regas.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and while Dean's looking up, I help bring astronomy down to Earth with lots of questions for Dean, seeing as he's a real-life astronomer. In this episode, we're talking about Mars and the Mars rover mission with Steve Squires, professor of astronomy at Cornell University and principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover mission. So 900 degrees on Venus.
Yeah, yeah. Mars, slightly better.
Okay.
Well, I mean, okay.
Like 800 degrees, but slightly better.
Slightly better. Well, normally it's below zero. So the average temperature on Mars is, 20, 30 below.
Mm-hmm.
That's on the daytime. And then nighttime comes around and then it drops to 150, 200 below zero, something like that.
So it has a nighttime, like we have a nighttime because of the sun and stuff.
Exactly. And Mars has a lot of similarities to Earth. Number one, it's tilted the same, almost the same way that the Earth's tilted. So Mars has seasons.
Okay.
But the seasons last twice as long because its orbit is almost twice as long. So you have spring for like 6 months and fall for 6 months and that kind of thing. And so we've recorded these high temperatures on Mars. The highest temperature is recorded right around 70, which sounds awesome.
70?
Summer on Mars during the daytime, pleasant.
Sign me up.
Right. But,
that's perfect.
But then you also get these weird extremes because once the sun goes down, there's no atmosphere, very little atmosphere to hold in the heat. So down to 100 below, just like that. So I know this is now, but as options go, if we look at Mercury, we look at Venus, we look at any of the other planets, you will pretty much die instantly on all the other planets.
And but people want to go to Mars. They're convinced we could do this.
Now, Mars, you wouldn't die instantly. You'd die.
When it got nighttime, slowly, it sounds like.
Slowly and painfully. But we can mitigate those things. We can wear suits. We can bring, regulate our temperatures. We can bring our air, our water, everything with us.
And just bring an electric blanket for those 70.
Those cold, cold nights.
That's right. The below, that's right. 20 or 30 below,
that's
whatever.
Right. Mars is for
just
lovers.
Throw on a sweater.
Snuggle up with your loved one on Mars.
But don't go outside.
But don't go outside. There's not enough heat in the universe for that.
Apparently not.
But that's why Mars is the place, because basically by default, it's the only place where
that's
we can
remotely
go. Right, because we're not going to go to Jupiter. We're not going to go to Saturn. Those are gas giant planets.
Yeah.
You can't stand on them. We could go to moons of other planets, and that's definitely could be in our future. But the closest realistic place for us to colonize would be Mars. That's the closest planet-like Earth-like place.
Yeah.
And even that's not that Earth-like.
Isn't it kind of tiny, too?
It is small. That's right. So Mars is about half the diameter of the Earth.
Okay.
But it's all land, so it has, there's no oceans, there's no lakes, that type of thing. But so there's a lot of places to go. And if I can be a tour guide for Mars, I mean, there are some pleasant places. I mean, first, tallest, largest volcano in the solar system, largest mountain in the solar system, called Olympus Mons.
I feel like a mountain and volcano have a very important difference. So what is it?
Well, okay, see, actually... Actually, there is a higher...
You really torque it. Like, it's a mountain. It's fine. It's
well,
just,
it's a mountain, but it's an
hike
extinct...
right over it.
It's an extinct volcano. It's like a... So, yeah. So it's
not
going to
spew anything. Oh, God.
Dormant, I guess we would say. It could come back.
The sales job is kind of falling off a little
but
bit.
But it's three like... times taller than Mount Everest. So
oh
imagine
gosh.
The hiking opportunities there.
Oh, yeah.
Then you've got the largest canyon in the solar system.
Some real extremes on Mars. Well,
yeah, so you do some bungee jumping down the canyon of Valles Marineris.
Oh, yeah.
It's five times deeper than the Grand Canyon.
That sounds utterly terrifying. Yeah.
So these aren't
it's
selling
like a,
you.
Like a chasm in the yeah. middle of like... Yes. I just dropped the word chasm. Yeah, that's intense. That sounds intense, actually.
Right. So then you've got dust storms. You've got dust devils.
What's a dust devil? It's like a vacuum? It sounds like a vacuum brand.
Well, you remember that one video of the plastic bag that was circling around because the wind was circling around it? It's like that, except more terrifying. Like dust that's swirling around and can pick you up and throw you. And then there's, global dust storms that we could actually see. From the Cincinnati Observatory telescope, we could see a dust storm covering half of Mars quite a few years ago. So, I'm selling
this. Sounds picturesque. This sounds
great, great, perfect.
Wow.
Perfect. Now, the thing is that if
we want to hop on Travelocity and book a flight.
That's right. Now, if we want to go there, that's. Oh, right. I have to tell you about that part.
Oh, God.
Getting to Mars is not fun either. It's a 7-month journey.
So, 7 months to get sucked into some kind of dust vortex.
No,
Satan
to see
thing.
A beautiful giant mountain larger than the United States and like, picturesque blue sunsets.
And the deepest canyon that goes
and the
like,
deepest canyon.
Like, what?
Right.
Okay.
Right. So all that, 7 months to get there to that pleasant place. And then if you want to come back, then you've got to wait 1 year for the Earth to come back around to you.
So I have to sit there for a year?
You have to.
I can't commit to a case for my iPhone for longer than about 2 weeks.
Oh,
and
man.
I have to commit to a year on Mars.
Imagine all the things that you'll miss on Earth. All the technology, all the fads.
So yeah, I can't. Do they have Wi-Fi up there?
They will have Wi-Fi
for
you.
Oh, well, then
I'm sure.
I'm fine.
You will be.
That's fine.
That's all you need.
If I
as you're falling in the chasm, you just as
I
long
just
as
need
you
to
can
be
text,
able to keep up.
Wee!
With.
That's what you'll say. Wee!
This is great.
Yep, perfect.
I'll text it. I'll put it on my Facebook status. It's a bunch of
Yep.
Wow.
So, and then you get back in the spacecraft and fly 7 months home.
Right.
So you've got to remember that part too.
Oh man.
So yeah,
and people want to do this. Like people are into it,
people
right?
People really are into this. And so currently what we've got is we've got a lot of robotic craft. So we've got a lot of orbiters that are circling around Mars that are taking these great high resolution images. So no humans have made
for a
this
travel
journey.
Brochure.
Oh yeah. I mean, actually you can pick, they can, these satellites, I know you're joking, but I'm serious.
Oh my God, your face just looked really serious.
This is serious.
Stop laughing.
This is like the greatest thing we've ever made.
I know, you're like, stop it. Wrap it up.
So we've got
lock it up.
We've got these actual cool, amazing, miraculous things there that, obviously I've been following them for a while.
Obviously.
That have been
really
orbiting
invested.
Around Mars. They can take pictures of, like, boulders the size of your hand, basically. They can get these high-resolution from satellite, from orbit. They can take these great pictures. They can even take pictures of the rovers that are on Mars.
Okay.
And so we do have these amazing details. So we could make a travel brochure. And you would love to go after we make that, I'm sure.
Right. I'm sure it'll be,
So Mars is our planet we know the most about out of all of the ones because it's under this constant monitoring. And now we've got two rovers on Mars that are still working. The Opportunity rover and the bigger one called Curiosity that's been climbing up this mountain.
The big tall mountain?
Not the big tall.
Oh,
that would have
okay.
been really cool if they climbed up the big tall mountain.
I just was curious.
By the way, Olympus Mons is my, if I was going to be a wrestler.
A wrestler? Oh my God, your name would be Olympus
Mons. Olympus Mons. Wouldn't that be good?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
This is a major moment.
I know. Should I get a little name tag? Olympus?
Or a t-shirt. And
now,
just has to say
announcing in the ring, weighing 130 pounds. Olympus Mons.
But then, like, don't show up until after they, like, say all that
right.
and then be like, here I am.
Here I am.
Like,
you're like, oh, the skinny guy's going to wrestle.
I like this juxtaposition. I think that's an interesting. Yes. Not going to think about what my wrestling name would
I know.
Be.
You need a good space wrestling name.
I got to work on this. Future show.
Yeah.
For a future show, for sure.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, anyway, back to Mars. So you're not going.
Nope. I'll check your voicemail for you while you're there.
Okay.
Yeah, because I'm like,
well, I thought about it. I mean, what
really?
If they offered.
And see, for a year?
I know. That's so
much. Who's going to feed your cats?
But think of the adventure. I mean, you're going to, you know.
Think of the dust storms.
Okay. You got me. Good point. That's a good point.
I'm speaking for the people here, Dean. This seems like.
That's
There's
true.
There's no way that people are excited about this.
Yeah, I'm really excited. We're going to be talking more about Mars and specifically the success of the Mars rover program. And we're going to be having astronomer and professor Steve Squires from Cornell University. And his research focuses on the robotic exploration of planetary surfaces and is a scientific principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover mission. Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, we're super psyched to learn a little bit more about the two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. These are the two ones that you were the principal investigator with. And so tell us a little bit about Spirit and Opportunity.
Well, we launched them back in 2004, which for what was supposed to be a 90-day mission. Spirit went for 6 years, made wonderful discoveries. Opportunity is still going today, almost 14 years into the mission. It's been an amazing ride.
So much for 90 days. Like, you signed up for a 3-month job and now it's turned into a decade,
like a career.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're tired, but we're still having fun.
And, so Spirit got stuck, correct? And so Spirit is no longer with us.
Yeah. Spirit is no longer with us. What happened, the terrain where Spirit landed is very rugged, really rocky, really steep. We really, really beat up that rover. You know, I always felt that the only honorable way for a mission to end would be either somehow Mars actively does something to kill the vehicle, like a big dust storm, or we wear it out. And what happened with Spirit was we wore it out. The right front wheel failed about 800 days into the mission, and then a few years later, the right rear wheel failed. And at that point, we could no longer really move the vehicle. And the way that we would always survive the winter with those vehicles would be to drive them onto slopes that would tilt the solar arrays towards the sun as the sun sinks low in the northern sky during the winter. And we were no longer able to do that with two dead wheels, and so Spirit didn't survive her last winter, and that was it.
Oh, man. Well, it still had four wheels left, right?
Yeah, but it with two dead wheels, you're trying to drag through the dirt, you just can't move.
Well, the part that I really was fascinated with was that, so when the rovers get stuck, you have like a spare rover here on Earth that you practice with.
Yeah. We actually built four of them, two complete flight-worthy rovers that we sent off to Mars, and then we have our hangar queens back on Earth. And what we do with those is we can use them to simulate predicaments that we've gotten ourselves into and then try, you know, different experiments to figure out how to get out of those predicaments. And they come in handy from time to time.
The way it looked like is like you guys just construct a giant sandbox and you put the toys in there and try to get them out.
It's basically that. It's not, we don't use sand. We've concocted this sort of special recipe to mimic the behavior of actual Martian soil. But it's basically playing in a sandbox.
Cool.
Yeah.
So when these things come up and there's problems or issues, or do you feel like an attachment or like a personify the rovers?
Yes. I worked 16 years just to get these things to the launch pad.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, and
so they're like your children.
Almost 14 years now. It's been 30 years.
Wow.
We're working on this in 1987. So, yes, we develop, you know, I mean, I get it. They're robots. They're made of metal. They're not alive. I get that. And to be calling them like children would be to trivialize parenthood. But we do develop a very deep attachment to them. And when they do well, we're proud. And when they, you know, get in trouble, we worry. And when they screw up, we get angry at them. And, you know, it's just, it's like, it's like, it's... it's a very personal, emotional thing.
I love it.
Very diplomatically said for all the parents out there. That was smooth, Steve. That was smooth.
Well, I'm a parent myself, so I get it.
So we had to delay our taping here because of a somewhat slight issue with one of the rovers. Can you tell us about it?
Opportunity had a bad day yesterday.
It did. Oh no.
So we're on some very steep, very rugged terrain. Some of the most difficult driving we've ever tried to do with this vehicle. And we popped a wheelie.
Whoa.
Yeah, this is not a good thing. This has happened before. We know how it happens. We know why it happened. But yeah, we got some downlink from Mars last night, and the right rear wheel is like, I don't know, 8 or 10 inches off the ground. That's not a good thing. Yeah, it was... like I said, we're on some really difficult terrain. We tried a very gnarly move. We thought it would work. We got an unpleasant surprise. The reason we had to delay the start of this interview was because I was in a meeting where we were talking about, okay, what are we going to do to fix this? It's pretty straightforward. We're trying to drive backwards uphill, and that was how the wheelie got popped.
Oh, man.
So we drive frontwards downhill, and we can pretty much unwind it and also get just down onto safer, more stable ground, and you know, we'll regroup and we'll come back in on Monday, see where things stand, and then get back to work.
Wow. Well, yeah, so what's coming up here for opportunity? What do we have going on?
We are engaged right now, and for me, what is one of the most exciting science campaigns of the whole 14-year mission. We are in a place that we have named Perseverance Valley, because it took us so damn long to get here.
Oh, man. Well, the rover's gone more than a marathon in distance, right?
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah. Oh. We've gone, it's getting close to 45 kilometers now.
Wow.
So, yeah. And they were designed to go 1 kilometer. So that's a lot.
That's pretty good outside the range of its warranty.
Yeah. So anyway, Perseverance Valley is, we believe, a little tiny water carved gully or channel. It was carved by water on Mars, we think, a very long time ago, like billions of years ago. And when I say water, I don't know if it was like a flowing stream or if it was a kind of a mudslide kind of thing or what. That's the kind of thing we're trying to work out. So we're in the thing right now. We entered it from the top. We're going down the whole length of it. It's probably about 300 meters or so long, about a 15-degree channel gradient. So that's pretty steep.
Wow, yeah,
right,
that's
now,
steep.
The rover, well, right now the rover tilt is 31 degrees.
Oh, my gosh.
That's almost our all-time record. So we're trying to do some difficult stuff. You know, we planned a 90-day mission. We targeted nice flat terrain. We spent the first 90 days on nice flat terrain with both rovers. So we're in extra time now, and we have been for more than a decade. And so we've done the easy stuff.
So it's all gravy from here.
Our job now is to do the hard stuff. And this is hard. What we're doing right now is really, really, really hard. It's one of the hardest things we've ever done with this vehicle. But the science payoff is going to be really cool.
That's so cool. So this is really exciting talking about the rovers, but I did want to ask you one question that's sort of from a different part of your work and career, if that's okay, Steve.
Sure.
I was curious about, you're an aquanaut?
Oh, that's a really different part of my career.
I know, but it sounds so cool. I didn't know that was even a thing.
That was very different. So, you know, when I was a young scientist, when I was figuring out what I wanted to do with my career, I was always fascinated by exploration, and I wanted to do field work. You know, I wanted to do stuff where I'd go out and get my boots dirty or do work underwater or something like that. And then when I realized that what I really wanted to do was Mars, it meant that I had to sort of give up the physical participation part myself and focus on robotics, because that's how we do Mars these days. Mm-hmm. So in order to kind of scratch that other itch, I from time to time am involved in various sorts of field research and so forth. And I was very, very fortunate to be a crew member on two NASA missions in the Aquarius underwater habitat, which is just off the coast of Key Largo in Florida. And
oh, wow.
A place where they conduct what are essentially simulated space missions, typically with a crew of four. I was a crew member for NEMO. The name of the program is NEMO.
Uh-huh.
And I was a crew member for NEMO 15 and NEMO 16. And I was the only non-astronaut on the crew. So there were three astronauts plus me on both of those missions. And It was an extraordinary experience. We were using the neutral buoyancy that is afforded by being underwater to simulate zero gravity. And we were doing a simulated asteroid mission and asking ourselves, how do you do, you know, asteroids are very small. They have essentially no gravity. How do you do geologic field work in zero gravity? Okay, we've done that on the moon, but the moon has 1/6 G. There, NASA's done lots of spacewalks, but asteroids don't have handrails. So how do you deal with that? I mean, if you just simply hit a rock with a rock hammer, you're going to go flying, right? Newton's laws. So it was a fascinating experience. I got to work with some just absolutely first-rate crewmates. Got to live underwater for 2 weeks. It was cool.
So you were back to the surface for 2 weeks?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
The first mission was supposed to be 2 weeks. We had to abort it after 6 days because we had a hurricane bearing down on us. We had to get out of the habitat. Second mission, I was down for the full 2 weeks, and it was just glorious.
Wow. I mean, it's like it's as close as you can get to the experience of being in space, but you're right here on Earth.
It's a really, really valuable training exercise for astronauts. What you'll find is that frequently for a young astronaut early in their career, kind of one of the last things that happens to them before they get their first flight assignment is they get assigned to an EMO crew, and it's a chance to sort of be in space without being in space yet.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. I was just kind of curious.
Yeah, nothing to do with Mars rover.
I know. So bringing it back a little bit, this is a very important question. Dean has decided that, you know, he wants to create a sort of a nickname, sort of another personification or another identity. And he's thinking about Olympus Mons as his sort of alter ego. What do you think?
Yeah, what do you think? Is that a viable name?
Do you think that's a good name? Do you have any input?
It's big.
Right. See, that's what I thought.
It's got a head made of rock.
Yeah.
Amen.
We're getting there. Getting there.
It's a spectacular thing. I mean, it's the largest volcano in the solar system. It's three times the height of Mount Everest. And across its base, it's as big as, you know, the state of New Mexico. So it's
exactly
a big thing.
It's exactly what I'm talking about.
That is like the most egotistical thing.
After a big pile of rocks, that's a big pile of rocks.
That's how we'll frame it. Perfect.
Yeah, thanks. Sounds good. Did you have a nickname in the Aquanaut world? Did they have
not really. Not that anybody said to my face anyway.
Oh, man.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for talking with us today. This was a lot of fun learning about Mars and undersea living. And it was just great talking with you today.
All right. Enjoy talking to you guys, too. Take care.
Thank you.
Well, Cincinnati Observatory has been around since the mid-1800s, so you can manage the many letters we've received in that time, some of which have some very interesting questions or assert some, we'll say, unique beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dean, you have one for us today that we're going to discuss?
I have a great Mars one. One goes back a long time. This predates the observatory.
Whoa.
Is the question, is Mars inhabited currently? That is the question. And so we've digged back to even pre-telescope days where people were questioning, is Mars inhabited? Are the other planets inhabited? If we go to the 1700s and 1800s, the answer, if you asked an expert, would have been absolutely. Mars is inhabited.
Wow, okay.
Because they could see through the telescopes and they could see these weird features on Mars.
Yeah.
And so they at first thought it was vegetation because it looks kind of green when you see it through the telescope. And then it would change, and they look at a different day, and then it would be gone. And so they thought it was, what's going on? And actually, I've experienced this when I look through the observatory scope.
Mm-hmm.
Our scope is at that same level that they had in the 1800s, because it's the main 1800s. And so I get to see what they saw. And so it does look like there's weird shapes on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And then so this guy, Percival Lowell, figures out, well, wait a second, these are lines on the planet. So they look like canals. And if they're canals, that means maybe a Martian intelligence had made the canals.
Like dug them?
Yes, to bring water from the poles to the dying civilization that's drying out from the drought and everything like that. See, this is what they thought was happening.
It's very, very dramatic.
All this from viewing from millions of miles away through little telescopes while they're squinting and trying to make out stuff. They're like, I think, do you see this? And other people are like, I don't see anything.
what are you talking about? Right.
But I see it, so I'm going to write it up.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
So this was widespread that, you know, turn of the century, turn of the 19th to 20th mm-hmm. century, it was essentially a done deal. Mars is inhabited. We know it. Absolutely.
Wow.
And then the crushing reality happens when we send a spacecraft there in the 60s, and they send back the pictures, the first pictures of the surface of Mars, the first close-up pictures. Mm-hmm. And what we see is this dry, desert, desolate place. I mean, the scientists, when they first saw it, they were like crushed.
They're so
like,
no water, no canals.
Not a drop of water, not a canal.
Not anything green waving.
No waving.
Whatever.
No waving. Algae,
committee.
Trees, nothing. Okay. Nothing waving.
All right.
And so they were like, oh my gosh, great. Mm-hmm. We did all this and Mars is dead.
Yeah.
This is deader than the moon. It just looked terrible. It looked like nobody wanted to go. So then we go fast forward a little more, and then we find out more about it. We say, well, wait a second. Our latest orbiters that are circling around there have been measuring the surface. And they say, well, wait a second. The Mars we see today is not the Mars that's always been there. And in the past, Mars had water, liquid water on the surface in great quantities, lakes and oceans.
Okay.
And so that water disappeared over these eons. Mm-hmm. But since it had a watery past, now people are thinking, well, wait a second. All we got to do is look carefully enough. Could there be fossilized life on the surface of Mars? And others that go even farther in the crank file and the mysterious ventures, they would say that underneath the ground, there could be life today.
What do you mean, like, underneath the ground? Like,
under like the surface. Like, yes, in underground caves.
Okay.
Now, this is what other people are saying. That's not what I'm saying. But this is what other people are saying.
So is there supposed to be water in these underneath?
Yes.
Underground caves?
Yes. And we have a lot of evidence that there is underground water on Mars in vast quantities. We sent this one spacecraft to land near the North Pole with a little scooper.
The North Pole on Mars?
Yes.
Okay.
And it scooped into the ground. Water came into the hole, filled in the hole, and froze.
What?
So there is water underneath the surface. That's right. So could there be life form? Underneath the surface,
like just under the surface, just like keep it down up there.
That's
with,
right.
with these rovers that's landing, like
that's right.
I don't know. I feel like they're probably like don't want to be disturbed.
Exactly.
Yet we keep disturbing them.
No, this is probably if there is something there, this is like very basic life, single celled organisms, that type
of
thing.
Oh,
but
okay.
There are things on Earth called extremophiles that live in these extreme environments, like volcano vents and the bottom of the oceans and in solid blocks of ice.
Extremophiles. Sorry.
I know. It sounds like I made that word up.
It really does.
I'll take credit for it, but that's not. No, I didn't make it up.
Okay.
But so now we've gone full circle. We were like in the 1800s, like, yeah, definitely there's life on Mars. Then 1960s, like, no way, Jose.
We really botched this.
Yeah, boy.
There's nothing.
Let's just not even look at Mars anymore.
Yeah.
And now we're like, maybe.
Interesting.
Maybe.
All right.
And all we need to do is send someone like you on that 7-month journey to go start digging some holes in the ground.
You know, I'm busy.
Are you in, Heyman? Are you in?
Absolutely not.
No.
I couldn't say no hard enough.
Oh, well. Nope.
I think you should go.
Yeah, well.
Do you think there's life up there? Oh, my gosh. Are you going to, like, leave everybody hanging? Okay.
I don't know.
I don't know. All right.
I will wait until we find out. I certainly hope so. I think that'd be the story of the century.
Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Professor Steve Squires for joining us. Get in touch with us. We want to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Looking Up Podcast, or drop us a note at lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can ask us a question, give us a topic suggestion, or ask your kids what they'd like to ask an astronomer or scientist, and we can try to answer those on future episodes.
And remember to subscribe to Looking Up on iTunes and rate us there, or on Stitcher, or from wvxu.org/lookingup. Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Rick Andrus is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.